I just want to point out the talk that comes before the fall of the ivory tower. That's scheduled for 4:30 today. This is 2 days before the complete collapse of the world into a black hole. This is scheduled for Wednesday, thanks to the Large Hadron Collider concern. I want to do a couple of connections before I start. I want to admire this building. I mean, I was stunned when I came around the corner from the hotel and walked up to this and saw that this entire building is dedicated to theoretical physics. And if ever there's been a case of physics envy, I'm a social scientist, I should point out. If there's ever been a case of physics envy, it was walking up to the beauty of this place. And I immediately tried to imagine what a building for social theory would be like, comparable to this. And the perimeter, I still haven't had a full explanation of why it's called perimeter. And I'm not sure in social theory whether we would be called the outlier institutes or the peripheral or potentially even the irrelevant social theory institute for advanced studies. But this is really a wonderful place. And as a Canadian, I'm just proud that we've got something like this. Here at an institution that's always been famous for its mathematics and physics and other areas. But I was here 20 years ago, so I want to just make a note of that. I haven't been here back since. In a topic that's very closely related to this. This is a very brief anecdote, and it takes us quickly to Oxford. By the way, have you noticed there are no PowerPoints? I know some of you looking at me nervously. I'm not going to use PowerPoint slides because this is a talk about public access, and I'm just going to talk to you. And I just wanted to make that clear. So you need to come with me visually. And you're welcome to, if you feel nervous about this, call up Oxford right now, please. Oxford University Press. Because I want to talk about the Oxford English Dictionary. So 20 years ago, well before Research in Motion and Open Text and all of these things that have made Waterloo famous since then, I was doing a study of the Oxford English Dictionary, and I was looking at the history, but how they put together the Oxford English Dictionary in the 19th century. It's known as the Great Victorian Research Engine. And part of the outstanding record of research. And although we associate it with Oxford University, it was really a school teacher, James Murray, who was at the forefront of the editing of it in the early days before Oxford took it, before the Bible sales started to fall off and they had all that onion skin paper they needed to. In that period when James Murray was editing, the kind of selection and making of the language fascinated me. And I was in the third, fourth floor of Oxford University Press, and the lovely houses they have, looking through the card catalog, and someone came by and stopped in, and I was copying down notes from how they'd chosen various sources for, it was from the letter TA to TE or something, it was going to take me weeks. And they said, well, actually, I don't know if you know about Canada, but at Waterloo University, they're digitizing the Oxford English Dictionary, and it seems kind of antiquated that you would be going through the card catalog. Are you familiar with Canada? So I quickly hide my accent and said, oh, really? Of course, I'm a research scientist. So you must mean Waterloo. And so, time traveled quickly to at Waterloo at the Center for the Oxford English Dictionary on campus. And we're able to say, and I remember I went through that card catalog, I'm now able to say, how many times is Shakespeare quoted in the OED? 32,000. Who are the top 10 authors quoted in the OED? Shakespeare, Sir Walter Scott? Charles Dickens, and that amazing kind of ability to capture was right here. And out of that did come open text and XML and various other developments. But the critical thing we need to think about is how public the Oxford English Dictionary was. It wasn't the Oxford English Dictionary in its first 50 years, first 30, 40 years. It was the English public dictionary. It was actually English Dictionary on Historical Principles, but it was put together by the public. And so James Murray sent out an advertisement and said, we need help putting together. We have this huge empire. We need to have a good historical record to back that up with a language that goes back to the very beginning of time and has been put together by the great writers of this language. And so he made this appeal to the public to send in quotations that would back and warrant a dictionary, much as Samuel Johnson had done on his own. But James Murray made it into this public project. And they were sent in, thousands of people sent in. And he was very wise about it. There was no internet, obviously. So he suggested they send in on half slips of paper, very economical school teacher. I totally identify with him as part of my background. He said half slips of paper, and he would pay the postage for this. And there are infamous stories of him sending out boxloads of 16th, 17th century books to get read, to get the quotations, and the books came back. The books didn't come back, sorry. Slips of paper came back with the books cut up into little half-slips of paper. And I know, so there are lovely, charming stories that his granddaughter has told in Caught in the Web of Words. But this, the scale of this public project, and this is all before Oxford agreed to take it over, but it has continued. And so for me, there's been always this interest about the public's role in scholarship. And this talk will be about the potential. We've seen blogs and other forms of publication. I can clearly bring in a good Newton story on the role of, in fact, I probably will have to. So forgive me. Bring in a Newton story on the role of the public, but that sense of the potential. And so a dictionary that we consider now to be the utmost authority in the English language, and it is. I've done my homework. But was constructed as a public project. And there are charming, one story. Marguerite Alasky changes the whole shape of the dictionary as she rides the trains around England. She is fascinated by detective fiction, and detective fiction had never been included as a citation. So when I was in Oxford, I was doing work on TA records, I was doing Tachometer. And three of the sources would be these highly technical things I couldn't understand. And the fourth one would be, as he sped away from the murder scene, he watched the revs increase on his tachometer. And I put in this little ballpoint pen. And this would be Marguerite Lasky sending in citations from her own reading and sending in over 100,000 in the areas of cooking and detective fiction, two areas that were not well covered previously in the Oxford English Dictionary. She had a way of shaping the language. And this public participation it is my theme, and ties me back to Waterloo in the most extreme way. Now, I need to set up the stage a bit with open access, because we've talked a lot today about access, but I don't think specifically on open access. Now, physicists. How many of you would count yourselves as physicists? And just don't hesitate. Some of you are proud of them. I'm full of envy for you right now. So it's a small proportion. Because explaining open access to physicists is like explaining water to fish. Because the physicists have been immersed in open access since the early 90s, thanks to Paul Ginsberg. And so that whole ability to understand what it means to have open access is somewhat missing. But for those of you who are not, you can appreciate that when I refer to open access, I'm referring to not a technical term, but a very specific designation. Open access has come to mean free access to journal articles, okay, specifically peer-reviewed journal articles. There is much dispute about this, of course. There's the number of angels dancing on the head of a pin, and there's what open access means, the two big issues that face us today. There is much dispute about it, but let me take open access to refer specifically to the peer-reviewed journal reach. Many of us want it to be immediately available. But the New England Journal of Medicine is freely available 6 months after it publishes each issue. All of its literature in that issue is made freely available. And I'm not one to quibble. That's 6 months. I'm very happy that the New England Journal of Medicine makes its work available after 6 months. But technically, maybe not open access. Highwire Press at Stanford University makes 1.9, you've got computers, update me here, 1.9 million articles available from medical journals, mostly, probably 80% on a kind of delayed 6, 12, 24-month basis. So the world of access to research is a critical aspect. And in context, in light of the blog, discussions about blog access, I want to look at access to the literature itself. I think the points made this morning, certainly Chad's points, about not everybody needs to blog, but that everybody will be doing research. And I think the question about whether we should depend on public access on blogs is for me not the issue, because that the mediation isn't perhaps as necessary as we thought. And so I want to look at, as it were, at what it means to have public open access leading to public access. Now, in terms of where I'm presenting from, what context, I am a social scientist. I work in a school of education, and I've been drawn into the open access movement as an educator, as someone who has worked hard to teach children to read. And at one point I looked up and said, why are we teaching them to read? Might it be that they would have this lifelong engagement with knowledge? No, because then they would need to have a university library card for the rest of their lives. Might it be for them to engage with Wikipedia or other public sources of knowledge? Well, it turns out to be yes, but I didn't know that originally. And so this idea that we would see the universities having a responsibility to contribute, as it were, to the knowledge landscape has become for me a critical issue. And my approach to open access, and this is, distinguishes me from most of the other people in this movement, is the concern with public access. That it means it's about the public access. And that most of the disputes, or most of the, not disputes, but the concern with open access has been research for other scientists, research in developing countries. And the big success story in open access has been developing countries. But all of Elsevier, the most expensive journals in the book, all of Elsevier's journals are freely available. All of Elsevier journals in medicine, excuse me, all of the medical literature and the agricultural literature and the environmental science literature is freely available in developing countries. There are contracts that have been negotiated that enable, for example, the University of Ghana, Legon, has 19,000 journals. And its collection. That's a very competent level of library service. And those are based on agreements for electronic access from publishers at 90% reduction of cost. That is, to me, a triumph of open access. And so the way that the knowledge landscape is changing is based on this increased access. The exact percentage, of course, we don't know. Is 15% of the literature is now open access? In physics, is it 90%? Is it 95%? But in all the other disciplines, 15 to 20% of the literature is available. And as an educator, I'm very interested in the impact, what this means. And the blogs are certainly the road to this. The research blogs, where the research articles are blogged, it seems to me a marvelous example. But people are encountering primary research, and I wanted to talk a bit about this. Let me go from the OED to the Sloan Digital Sky survey. Are you familiar with this? Where 100,000 citizens, I don't love the way that you call them citizens, citizens of the democracy of science, the republic of science, of course, 100,000 citizens are checking galaxies, are part of a James Murray OED-like army of people doing some of the grunt work without getting degrees or credits. In terms of analyzing galaxies. And Hanny is her name? Is it Hanny? Discovered this new creature. Is it Hanny? I got her name right. A Vorwerk? Sorry?
Vorwerk.
Okay, Vorwerk. Stands for object? I thought it was some marvelous discovery. It's blue and kind of, imagine these people. Stars, blue blob. Okay? That's it. So there's this public participation and the wealth of sense by which people get on, go online, go to Galaxy Zoo, and begin to identify galaxies and strange objects in space, the blob that over the galaxy. So there is that sense of it for me. And then it goes, takes one step further with the IAPPP, the International Amateur Professional Photoelectric Photometry organization. So this is a group of amateurs who are taking pictures of the sky, astronomy, astronomical pictures, and are proud of their publication record. And so they are listing 518 publications in peer-reviewed journals, not only the Astrophysical Journal, the Astrophysical Journal Letters and the Astrophysical Journal Supplement. That whole pride of publication is there. So amateurs are partnering, as it were, with professionals because amateurs have time to take photographs and look at space. If a comet is going to hit the Earth, it's going to be seen by amateur with telescopes. It's not going to be seen by professionals because they're in their lab writing up the article that they got from the 2 weeks that they were head of observatory time in order to get tenure and promotion. So this idea that the public, the one level, now I'll look at a number of levels. One level is the amateur. We have dedicated amateurs. And let me deal with the Newton instance in this case. So dedicated, I've done with James Murray and the OED. Dedicated amateurs are working on, no, sorry, not amateurs. Interested public are working on galaxies. Dedicated amateurs are working on the mapping of the sky and astronomy. The question with Newton in terms of the dedicated amateur is the tidal question. Is Newton on the beach? You've seen that opera. But Newton on the beach is a big question in the biography of Newton. We don't know, at least I don't, if Newton ever stood on a beach. Now, if you know Newton's work, he made, as it were, astounding calculations about tidal performance, tidal movements, and that he was able to do so without perhaps visiting the beach, or certainly not noting it, or certainly not making any observations directly himself. He may have gone just gets a few rays and surf off Southampton or something, but he didn't apparently visit Lake Austin because he had a team, not a team, I don't know what to call it, he had a group of correspondents, that's what they were. They were simply correspondents, and that they would correspond with Newton and provide him with tidal information from as far away as Southeast Asia, where the tidal forms produce very interesting results and part of the challenge for him to solve mathematically. And in a similar case with Darwin, that there were interested amateurs that helped Darwin make his case, and that although he traveled in the Beagle famously, the real bulk of his work is based on the continuing correspondence. And so the correspondence, maybe that's my theme, the correspondence between public and professional, between scientist and citizen. When you made your little triangle, the magic triangle, we had society, a.k.a. taxpayer. I want to expand that out a little bit. And I want to put in professionals and policymakers and amateurs. But let me deal with the notion of the professional and the paraprofessional. The question for us with open access is a community is getting access to information. And there are amazing cases, not amazing cases, interesting cases of patients coming into doctors' offices. So this is still this is the interested amateur in a sense, but not really even an amateur in terms of medicine. This is just the interested patient, and that whole response from the public, sorry, from the physician, has been transformed. They were going to call it originally, something like patient intimidation. One doctor I talked to, I referred to it as a time suck, patients bringing in medical information, but the AMA. Sent it out for review to their focus group and their public relations department, and they came back with shared decision making. And so patients bringing in information is leading to a more democratic shared decision making. And in Georgia, doctors can now, and bill for it, write prescriptions, information prescriptions for patients to begin to explore, as it were, conditions that they may be afflicted with. So that idea that the public is beginning to engage brings in this notion of the professional. Because the doctors who have been interviewed on this, in one study in Glasgow, said that what was fascinating for them, although some of them did find it a time waste, was that it was mostly research they hadn't had time to find themselves. That in fact, the patients were contributing to the education of professionals because of open access, because they had access. Now, the doctor said they preferred it was printed in color on shiny paper, and they all have concerns about that, but that seems to me a side issue. So what we've been looking at in particular, and physics is not the issue here, this is health, but if there's something comparable to archive.org, and that's PubMed. So PubMed is that wonderful resource in the life sciences where everything is indexed. Not everything is free. Again, about 10-15% on PubMed, very clearly indicated. Little green bar, little icon of a document with a green bar on it. But the public are going into that. When PubMed opened, the number of inquiries into MedLife increased 100-fold because of that public access. And what we've been studying, what we were looking at, was paraprofessionals. What does it mean for, as it were, registered massage therapists and having access to this medical information? What does it mean to that whole community, that health economy that operates outside of the traditional medical research paradigm? And what we were fascinated by is that the registered massage therapists who came to us to work and showed an interest were deeply concerned and engaged with the research. In fact, they were repeatedly frustrated by their inability to call up the full text. And they felt that they weren't in a position to judge whether the article would be of value to their practice or to their patients or clients unless they could see the full text. And they were interested as well in the methodology. In the very, as it were, the heart of it. So the abstract was not sufficient. PubMed is full of abstracts. Was not sufficient for them. And the possibility then, at no extra cost, to improve the entire quality of healthcare at a level where you may consider it to be not, as it were, official health, but where many, many people find relief and comfort, solace, seems to me a very powerful effect that only relies on one aspect, and that is when an article is published in whatever journal one wants to publish it in, one makes sure that it's also open access. And let me just take one moment to briefly explain how that happens. Do we have anyone in health sciences? Yes. Oh, not feeling well? Or, oh, no. You're working on your own
time.
Okay. Well, it's true in the UK with Wellcome Trust, and it is true in Canada with CIHR, Canadian Institute of Health Research, for those who are not familiar, and it's true in the United States at NIH. All of those agencies now require you to make a copy of anything you publish, wherever you want to publish it, freely available. 12 months, or 6 months. 12 months on average, or not average, 12 months in two of the major cases, 12 months available, 12 months after it's been published. And so there's beginning to be this recognition. Among the major publishers, 62% of them make this as part of their agreement. You give us all of the rights to the work that was paid for by taxpayers. You give us all the rights of your original work, and you peer review some of our other work, and in return, because we're fair, in return, we will give you the right to post your final, not our final, your final draft up on a website some period of time, 6, 12 months, some immediately after it's been published. And what's happened up to now, up to those mandates, up until NIH required of the $28 billion of funds each year, until it was required, no one was 10% again, 15% were doing. Because a scientist, too busy. A scientist, we've got other things to do. A scientist, we've got to check our whatever. And so there's been a slowness. And this notion of the mandate, this notion that funding agencies will require it as a result of that. And I'm very happy about it because it is, people are ready to comply once it's required. And at one point, we'll look at the metrics. We're sort of part of this forum, we'll be discussing the metrics. But part of the metrics of this is it increases, strangely enough, the number of citations. If an article is more freely available, more widely available, if it is available almost immediately prior to publication, but almost immediately after its acceptance, it gets cited more often.
Why is that a surprise?
It's a surprise because people have access to the literature already through their libraries, because people have a kind of habit of mind in terms of checking the literature, and clearly they're going outside of it. Clearly they're beginning to look at these archives. And some of the factors are as high as 300%. Increase the number of citations. So when we look at the career consequences, when we look at the impact of asking faculty to participate, we can say, in fact, I would put it out as a kind of time-limited offer. You don't have to participate in open access right now unless you're in the health sciences. You can wait. Your colleague two doors down from you is going to have a 300% increase in citations. And the corner office that's coming free in 6 months, you do the math. Figure it out. So the possibility that for the next 5 years, let's say, before open access becomes absolutely de rigueur for everyone, there's going to be this kind of discrepancy that those who make their work freely available will see it more widely cited, more frequently cited, more cited earlier. And again, that literature is an interesting literature in terms of debate and dispute, but the results, the causes, the results are relatively consistent. As literature goes. So we have the paraprofessionals. Let me consider a couple of those. Let me consider policymakers. There's been some discussion about impact on policymakers. NSF has come up, the funding has come up, and the point was made this morning, well taken, that anyone can cut the research. It doesn't seem to have consequences. But let me talk about the impact of open access. We did a study in Ottawa with policymakers and asked them about this new phenomenon of open access. And they knew about it because they didn't have subscriptions to journals. Because the only way they could get information on their desktop was open access information. They could go down to the library. There's a wonderful library, parliamentary library. The only thing that didn't burn 100 years ago. What if the library down there? But they didn't have time because we didn't understand this part. The policy-making window of research and briefing is 20 minutes. Not 20 days, not 20 weeks. But they had 20 minutes to, as it were, call up briefing materials for their minister. And in that time, they would end up going online. And what they discovered, in fact, they hardly even realized, was open access literature. And what was most exciting for us, except in the Bank of Canada, The Bank of Canada, they said, no, we have subscriptions to all of the major economic journals. Thank you very much. We don't need to traffic in open access. Everywhere else, health, justice, all of the others said they were completely dependent on open access. And what was most interesting for us was we asked them what they did before open access. What they did before open access was what would be termed cronyism. They phoned the last professor they had in the particular area, agriculture, immigration, and asked what was new. What was the latest? What's the current finding in the research? And that professor would give them that information. And that, to me, was kind of not the best evidence-based approach to policymaking. That, to me, was cronyism. And that the possibility of them discovering, as it were, a whole new generation of scholars who put their work online, who see as their responsibility to make their work public, and beginning to shape public policy because it's the only work that is currently available, was an exciting development. So when we think about open access, when you think about the way in which you deposit and, as it were, shepherd your work, we need to think about it in terms of concerned and dedicated amateurs. Although we've had mention about perpetual motion papers, and we talked here last night about that, there's still that element. There's still an element of quackery in all of that. But at the same time, this ability to discover research, and to make, and I'll talk a bit more about quality assurances at the end of this. But let me continue with the last one. And this is this area of knowledge creation. As we talk about amateurs contributing, but what about knowledge creation? What about Wikipedia? What about this possibility of actually creating knowledge and relationships to institutions like universities? So part of the work that I do, and part of the work this project I'm involved in called the Public Knowledge Project, is to look at the relationship of research and public enterprises like Wikipedia. And we've done a couple of studies I'm working on right now, in fact, is on the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy and Wikipedia. Okay? What Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy is this odd piece that is peer-reviewed encyclopedia. Peer-reviewed and updated. Peer-reviewed and articles that challenge each other. Peer-reviewed and a kind of description among the field of what in fact is being shaped rather than directly from the center. And so this possibility on the one hand, but all public access, all open access, and Wikipedia. Because one of the things we found with Wikipedia is it too often leads to a dead end. There are more and more citations in Wikipedia. You just can't get to them unless you've got a very good library, unless you're already a member of a very good library. And how often when people get engaged do they, in fact, make that leap? And the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, in the whole area of philosophy, is the one source they turn to. So in Aristotle, out of all of the citations, there were 60 or so references in the article on Aristotle. Only three of them could you begin to check, and one of those was the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. And what we're finding is that thousands of people a week are making that leap from Wikipedia to the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. And so the whole question about the quality of this public knowledge is you be the judge. And the other place that the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy is showing up is on the discussion page. So if you have looked, the ratio sometimes, if you take an entry like atheism, for example, the ratio of article to discussion is 10 times as long. It's archived incredibly to incredible depths, and the article itself is just trimmed very nicely, and 9,000, 10,000 words. But in that discussion page, there are repeated references and a kind of cascading or escalating, maybe that's an escalating debate in the use of these publicly available references. And so articles on the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy are being used to refine and define and discuss and learn, as it were, very obtuse elements, very very difficult questions, certainly with atheism and agnosticism. That difference between the two, are you ready to make a judgment about that? It's difficult. And so those kinds of distinctions are now being debated publicly as part of a public encyclopedia, and the academy is inadvertently contributing, except it's not inadvertent. Because in fact, across the United States and Canada, philosophy departments have been contributing $15,000 each to create an endowment for the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. So there is this wonderful kind of flow. The libraries and the philosophy departments, let's be fair, philosophy department wouldn't have $15,000 to contribute to, so they go work with the library, but $15,000 would be a lifetime grant to a philosopher, sustaining ground, philosopher, erasers, you do them, you know, pencils, legal size notebooks, for life. So this different kind of flow of information, different kind of access to the institution. And so what might seem inadvertent in its contribution, or maybe unintended in its contribution, becomes critical in terms of this relationship to the AKA taxpayer, in relationship to this public support, in building on the strong support. And so even though the public may not know, in fact, I rethought the whole laser question, because it's true or false is the wrong way. I had to ask, is it about sound or is it about light? Because if you say true or false, it's like, I don't know where that powerful ray of light comes from. It could be sound. So it just was the word.
The electron one, though.
The electron one you caught me for. But there is, but at the same time, it works both ways, because then you get 300,000 people a month coming into these blogs with an interest in science. And you have a generation of teachers and students who have access like they've never had before, who are going to do better, certainly on those reports. But let me conclude with one more aspect in terms of the work that we've been doing. So we have stepped in, when I say we, this public knowledge project, the social sciences large, have stepped in and said, what can we do? The particular issue we have as educators is that we cannot retroactively educate an entire population to read research. We have to create a different kind of reading. We have to create a situation where, as a responsible educator, they can come across research and do the best they can. We know there are two key elements to reading in terms of teaching kids to read. And very simply, and I give this to you, it would take you 4 years to earn your Bachelor of Education normally to get this, but it's such a pleasure to be here. I'm happy to share this with you. The two key elements are motivation and context. If a child is motivated and they have some background knowledge, some context to bring, then they do marvelously well. Well, when it comes to reading health information from PubMed online, guess what? We have 10 million people who are motivated, highly motivated, by very sincere and poignant often reasons. And they come online and they're motivated, but they don't have any context. They don't have any background. They don't have any vocabulary. They don't have any of those elements. So what we've done as part of our work is we've tried to create that kind of context. We have a toolbar on the side of our, sorry, let me give you a bit more context. Where's that toolbar? We produce a journal system, a journal management system that publishes, the journals use to publish. Well, 2,000 journals use our management system to make their journal electronic. It's open source. It reduces their cost, and we hope and we believe that they will then make their work freely available because they've reduced all of their major costs. Elsevier has not bought it. But then it's open source, so it's not for sale. So we're not working there. But in developing countries, the majority of these 2,000 journals are in developing countries. And they are now, in Africa, there are over 300 journals that are available online because of a system like this. So the system, that's one thing, to put the work online. And you'll notice that accessibility has a kind of, or sorry, access and accessibility have multiple meanings, right? So when I say open access, it's free to read, but does that mean that it's accessible to me? Well, for most of the theoretical physics, no. And so we have this other responsibility where we're enabling the work to become freely available. But we also have to make the work, as it were, accessible in another way. So we're providing this little set of tools, very common in publishing, a little toolbar, but ours is distinguished in a couple of ways. You can look in that toolbar, and the policymakers in Ottawa said, oh yeah, we need to know. I'm not going into my minister unless I know. Harvard, Princeton, Yale. Sorry, we're making notes manually. Harvard, Princeton, Yale. Had to be this research. This is Ottawa, Canada. This hurt me deeply. It was at the University of British Columbia at the time. I said, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, UBC? I'm sorry. they needed to know the background. That was their whole judge of quality. Not even the publication source for them. This is very deeply disappointing. And so we provide that kind of information. We provide a button, and this is very common too. Show me other articles by this author. But we provide a list of buttons, and I want to go over a bit more in detail, that say to readers, you can check the quality of this work. You can build a background on the spot. Because we also say, show us other works by this author, right? So that they can begin to see the work the author has worked in this area. Then we have one called media. Show us any articles that are available in the media, New York Times, Globe and Mail, that relate to this topic. We get the keywords from the author. It's all automatic. The New York Times did us a huge favor. I don't know if they did it specifically for us. But the New York Times only gave us 7 days free. So we could only allow the readers to go back 7 days. Last summer, not this summer, last summer, they gave us 28 years. Well, we gave everybody. 28 years. So people can go back 28 years now and begin to understand these background issues. We have a government link that says, show me government materials on this. Okay, so what are the government policies around, for example, medication and pharmaceutical resources on this issue? So we say the article exists within a larger world of knowledge. And it's very easy for us to use publicly available resources like the Canadian government and First Gov in the United States to begin to bring those resources, that context, that missing context, to bear. We have instructional resources. What if I wanted to teach this in my high school class? Some history on the War of 1812. Let's take a successful one for us. So they can begin to see that in fact there are resources available to take the article, the literature, that the author has, with the author is only good at one thing, and that is producing a scholarly article. But what we're good at is beginning to build the public resources around it so that this work has a context. What we're thinking about in this is that this is a different approach to education. It's not about teaching kids information literacy, although I do think we should do that. It's about building and changing the context in which information circulates. It's building it in a way, and Wikipedia connections are right there as well. It's building it in a way that says you have a right to this knowledge, and we have a responsibility with regard to this knowledge. You have a right to this knowledge, and we have to build resources. No, first responsibility, we have to make it available. That's just the basic. And the publishers are allowing us, and the funders are requiring it, so we have to take whatever steps to make it freely available. And then other people, this is literal, other people, such as myself working in education, need to build, as it were, a context, that information. And then as a result of that, the triangle becomes, as it were, a cloud. The triangle becomes not so rigorously defined, strongest geometric figure possible, but becomes a more loose, a more open aspect. And so where the public are, where the AKA taxpayers are, is more diffuse. They are participating as amateurs. They are engaged as professionals. They are concerned as parents and citizens. And our responsibility as researchers and scientists is to make that work open in the first instance.
Thank you very much.
Do we want to go to you, sir?
Do we have time for questions?
Yes, definitely.
John, you mentioned the community benefit that occurred in the creation of the OED, or what became the OED, due to the contributions of the community. In this regard, with this system, you're certainly enhancing or giving great value or creating added value to the knowledge. What I see lacking is the knowledge of the amateur from his or her experience that can contribute to a wider engagement, enhancement of the knowledge base. I know it occurs in separate chat rooms and blogs, but I think one needs to consider a social network as the larger context, since I have an experience. I'm not just an article or a comment or a footnote. I have real experience that can benefit the larger community.
And you don't feel that the blogosphere provides that opportunity? Or?
I think it's necessary to have a context and a framework and an integration instead of having separate universes. I worked for many years at a research center at Iowa State that was focused on traditional knowledge, indigenous knowledge, particularly in the area of agriculture and engineering. And there were so many, there was so much benefit that many have discovered and continue to discover of the local perspective on problem solving that, in fact, created more of a sustainable solution to the problem at hand. So I think we, the people, can, in fact, create a greater good by participating in the information flow, the experience flow, the creation of a more public knowledge.
And I do, in some ways, I'm playing it fairly conservative because that's a step ahead. And in trying to convince people just to make their work open and free without any changes has been the focus for us. And so I haven't talked, for example, about the blog and the relationship between the journal and the blog and new forms of publishing. And that's because I'm not with the 20% of early adopters, I'm working with the 80% foot dragons. But I think that will have that impact. Because one of the things we know from children, again, from my experience as a teacher, is the audience shapes the writing. As soon as the parents become the audience, as soon as the community becomes the audience, children's writing changes. And they gain a sensitivity. And again, Chad, you mentioned the voice, finding a voice. There's a voice finding. And so the teacher in me says, if you just make your work public, that's enough. But behind that devious pair of glasses that I'm wearing, that goes, I'm saying to myself that if you make your work public, it will change your work. And you will start paying attention to the world in a different way.
Yeah, it's a new model of undergraduate education, which extends the liberal art paradigm to something more, I think, appropriate, which is called the student as scholar model. In fact, I think we should look upon a different paradigm and a different framework in which if we want to garner public support, we need to recognize the potential benefit, both financially and politically, that can accrue if we engage the public in this enterprise.
Yeah, I mean, I'm waiting for that. We need structures that would assist that facilitate.
Yeah.
I really like to hear that you try to create bridges between MedLife, in this case, maybe the descriptions which you find on medical terms in Wikipedia, and that you also use science news, which are actually supposedly bridges between
yes.
this also. Is there a website that you could go to see and how far this works with you?
The study I shared with you right now is still in I'm still working on it. In fact, we just found kind of flowing the data yesterday. So I'm not using figures with you. The Public Knowledge Project is where our work exists. And the publications and the policymakers and all of those things are available to the Public Knowledge Project because, of course, if I didn't make my work free, what would that mean? So for $20, each paper is available. Do you have a credit card? immediate download, though. Can you see it? The work is available. And the bridging, I mean, the physics side for me, the reason we're doing the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, you might guess this, but it's because we have access to their web model. We can tell who, because we're working with them, we can tell exactly who has gone from Wikipedia to the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. What would be the comparable study, and Paul's not here, but what would be the comparable study would be archive.org and Wikipedia. Because then we could tell exactly who went from Wikipedia to archive.org, and there are many papers in Wikipedia, some of the work we've done. I mean, the shame of it all is we found 2% of the articles, 2% of the entries in Wikipedia have open access research, quality research they linked. And we think it could be around 60% given the current state of open access literature. So that potential is there. Yeah.
I'm wondering how many of these, how many of the general comments you're making on open access can be applied to all fields. Like I think there was a paper that I saw on Archive last year that said that the number of citations for open access articles that appear in National Physical Journal did not increase when they were made open access.
There's actually a new study at Madrid Medical Journal that was looking at physiology journals, and for at least the first year after they were published, there wasn't an increase in citations. There was increases in downloads and views and all kinds of stuff, but that first year,
so
not.
Phil Davidson study. So yeah. The astrophysical world is a special case because of the extent of the literature that's available online. And my understanding was they were earlier citations. So you could, as it were, your career path could perhaps be accelerated. But so each field has its own, I agree, there's a tendency to generalize here. The results, even with the British Medical Journal, was an increased download rate, which to me actually makes more sense. Because it's people reading the articles, it's not researchers who are citing the articles. In the astrophysical case where so much of the literature is already available, then I wouldn't expect to see, it would be very difficult to find articles that would be up in the live outside of that open access realm, and they probably wouldn't be the best articles. But I don't want to go case by case, but let me appreciate the fact that there are differences.
I also see problems that people might not upload their papers, they might more likely upload the really good stuff.
Yeah,
and therefore, this stuff's going to get more stuff.
And heaven forbid they should only cite the very good stuff. And I know it's, but you know, it's right. This is another the quality bias thing. And these are the disputes that keep our field so vital and fill our because we again, it's those dancing angels and things like that. But it's the quality of research. The 300% was in the National Academy of Science yearbook, increase in citations, and was a limited study, and I need to qualify that as well. In my own field, it was found to be 80% increase in citations. In philosophy, it was as low as 50% because they never cite each other. It's all Plato.
You very carefully steered away from the role of reuse and open access and that whole debate. I was wondering, do you have any comments on the extent to which you have found there are limitations and where something is freely accessible but not freely reusable in the type of context you're talking about providing?
Those are delicate issues, or not delicate, but there's a myriad of issues involved in that. And what open access, part of the work in open access has been to define what are the ideal conditions of access. So can we do data mining of the article? What kind of reuse and repurposing can go on? And so I do steer away from those because I argue for an access principle. Anything that increases the access to this work is for me progress. And I don't want to draw a line that says too limited in its access, no sharing of metadata or whatever. And that's why I use the New England Journal of Medicine as an example. But there are, certainly we, as this progresses, as this field progresses and as mandates come into place, then we need to help people understand what it means to really make things open access. And the Creative Commons licensing and other possibilities are a part of that.
You mentioned in your story about Ottawa and policymakers only getting 20 minute briefings.
It wasn't a story. The story was me coming here. That's very good. But yes.
Then is that actually the case?
Oh, no. The research does not establish that they only have 20 minutes for their briefings. That was anecdotal. You're absolutely right. The case was that they are using open access research. People did use that. 20 minutes was definitely something someone said to us. And they all of us said they were crunched for time. But I don't want to say that our country is run on it, and certainly not this government at this time. now that we face an election, that it's a 20-minute, no. You're right. I should qualify that. One policymaker used that expression, but repeatedly people said there was a time crunch, which prevented them from doing the thorough research.
Is 20 minutes too high or too low?
From that study, what amazed me was that most of them didn't know it was open access. They were just, as they didn't know there was any kind of issue, they were just using the research they found. And they knew they had no budget. And there were some studies they couldn't access because they needed a credit card. And they were just using the other studies. So it was again, a case of implication or impact without full appreciation of the issue. Because otherwise, why wouldn't the government then say all work should be made freely available? And we do. We CIHR, one of our three funding agencies in this country, has a mandate. The other, I should just point out one thing. The one in my field, Social Science and Humanities Research Council. The Social Science and Humanities now funds open access journals. And this was a big issue. In a country like Canada, we need to have our research, not our research, we need a research funded, of course, but our journals need to be subsidized and have been traditionally subsidized. And so we are now, and the cutoff point was 200 subscribers. You had to have 200 subscribers. It's kind of a sad story. in order for a journal to get funding. And open access journals would have 5,000 readers signed up and could get no funding because they had, when the question was, well, how many subscribers do you have? They would proudly say, none. And they would say, and so is your funding. And so that has changed. And so, so we are seeing among, and I think I would refer to it as a growing public expectation of a right to know. And certainly that's been part of the NIH emphasis and the mandate and is now part of, I think, of the Canadian.
In that case, let's thank our speaker again. And remember, we're going downstairs for discussion on the third floor.